Imagine a massive, like, global seesaw.
Okay.
For centuries, all the weight, all the wealth, the military might, it's all been heavily tilted toward the east, you know?
Yeah.
You have the Babylonians, the Persians, these massive, sprawling empires just dictating the whole flow of human history.
Right, absolutely.
And then in the span of just 13 short years, one man comes along and just slams his entire weight onto the other side. The center of the world tilts violently to the west, and frankly, it has never fully tilted back.
Yeah, it remains arguably the most dramatic geopolitical pivot point in, well, recorded history. And the fact that it was orchestrated by someone who, barely lived long enough to get a few gray hairs makes it all the more compelling.
Welcome to today's deep dive, where we are taking you on a journey into the life, the psychology, and the absolute chaos of a man who conquered the known world before his 33rd birthday. We're talking about Alexander the Great.
A fascinating guy.
We're pulling today from a really incredible lecture by Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino, which focuses on Judaism before Jesus. Our mission today is to kind of cut through that pristine marble statue myth of the great warrior. We want to look at how he actually pulled this off.
Right, the mechanics of it.
Exactly, the modern psychological warfare he deployed, and what happens when a leader's ambition just completely outpaces the physical endurance of his own army.
Because the reality of this campaign is so much more nuanced and honestly brutal and bizarre than the standard textbook summaries suggest. I mean, we are talking about a collision of cultures that completely redrew the ancient map.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because before Alexander even steps onto the stage, we need to look at the board, right?
Right.
The world is highly unstable.
Yeah.
The massive Persian Empire is actually broke. They literally lack the liquid capital to launch any more invasions into Greece. Meanwhile, the Greeks, they have a very long, very bitter memory.
Oh, yeah. They wanted revenge for those past Persian invasions.
Right, but they are completely incapable of mounting an offensive because the city-states are just too busy fighting each other in these endless localized wars.
Yeah, and to understand how that stalemate finally breaks, you really have to look at Alexander's father, Philip of Macedon.
Right.
Now, the sophisticated Greeks of like Athens and Sparta, they really looked down on the Macedonians. They viewed them as these uncultured northern barbarians who drink their wine unmixed.
Power.
Right. But Philip was a remarkably capable observer. Years prior, he had actually been held as a hostage in Thebes. And at the time, Thebes had the premier military force in Greece.
So he's basically a prisoner of war.
Exactly. But instead of just languishing in a cell, Philip spent his captivity meticulously studying Greek battle tactics. He's identifying their weaknesses and figuring out how to weaponize them.
It's like the ultimate story of corporate espionage, right? An outsider taking a broken system and completely optimizing it. He takes their warfare model, vastly improves the weaponry, and then brings it back to Macedonia.
And from there, he systematically conquers and unites the fractured Greek city-states by overwhelming
You
force.
must have hated that.
Oh, they resented him deeply. But Philip laid the essential structural groundwork. And then in 336 BC, he is assassinated, suddenly thrusting a 20-year-old Alexander onto the throne.
Which is where the historical record immediately begins, like blurring with mythology, because Philip wanted his heir to have this unshakable intellectual foundation, so he hired Aristotle to be his private tutor.
Not a bad tutor to have.
Right. So Alexander grows up heavily steeped in this philosophy that Greek culture is the absolute unquestionable pinnacle of human existence, and that all non-Greeks are essentially barbarians who need civilizing.
Yeah, and then you add his mother, Olympias, into that psychological mix. She is a fascinating, deeply ambitious figure.
The Snake Lady.
Yes, the rumors surrounding her were just wild. She was said to be a mystic who literally slept with snakes. But more critically, she actively cultivated the rumor that Philip wasn't Alexander's biological father.
Right. She claimed she had been impregnated by Zeus himself, who supposedly visited her in the form of a serpent. Now, I have to push back on the traditional narrative here. Based on the source material, did Alexander genuinely wake up every morning believing he was a literal demigod? Or was this just highly sophisticated PR orchestrated by his mom?
Well, the evidence points to a really potent blend of both. I mean, think about it. When you are tutored by Aristotle to believe your culture is inherently superior,
Right.
and your mother relentlessly conditions you to believe your bloodline is divine, it forges a very specific, unbreakable psychology. He didn't view his campaigns as mere territorial land grabs.
He internalized them as a crusade.
Exactly. He truly believed he was cosmically destined to liberate the Greek colonies in Asia Minor from Persian rule. He thought he was bringing order to a chaotic world.
And he immediately demonstrates that he operates without hesitation.
Sure.
Like when he takes power at 20, the city of Thebes decides to test the waters. They rebel, assuming the boy king is weak.
Big mistake. Huge. Alexander marches in and utterly annihilates the city. He burns the infrastructure, massacres the men, women, and children. It is a calculated, horrific display of absolute force.
Yeah, it instantly terrified the rest of Greece into total submission. He secured his home base through sheer, undeniable terror. And with the threat of Greek rebellion neutralized, he could finally turn toward the ultimate prize, which was Persia. So he amasses an army of 40,000 troops and crosses the Dardanelles into Asia. And you would think the Persians would be, like, waiting on the beaches.
You just think so.
But instead, the response to this highly anticipated invasion is just shocking incompetence.
It really is. The later Persian rulers had grown incredibly complacent. Alexander's movements were not a secret. Yet the Persian leadership left the frontier almost entirely unfortified.
They just let him walk right in.
They allowed a massive invasion force to simply walk through the front door.
And as he marches through, we get that legendary Gordian knot incident in Phrygia. There's this ancient, supposedly unbreakable knot tied around an ox yoke. And the local prophecy says whoever unties it rules the world.
Right.
Alexander looks at it, realizes he can't untie it normally, and just draws his sword and slices it in half. And everyone just accepts this. They're like, yep, prophecy fulfilled.
It's basically cheating, but it encapsulates his entire strategic philosophy. He absolutely refused to be constrained by the rules or limitations that governed other leaders.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I want to talk about the physical reality of the actual battles. When he finally meets the massive Persian forces, the casualty numbers seem almost absurd.
They do.
At the Battle of Granicus, the Greek records claim Alexander lost only 110 men. And at Issus, he completely routs the army led by the Persian king himself, Darius III. Darius actually panics and flees, abandoning his own family.
Yeah, his wife and children, whom Alexander, in a very calculated move, treats as honored guests.
So you might be wondering how a 20-year-old with a smaller force just steamrolls a massive empire.
Yeah.
And the Greeks weren't just brave, right? They brought a terrifying technological advantage with the Macedonian phalanx. Specifically, the Sarissa.
Right. The Sarissa completely changed the geometry of ancient warfare. A standard Greek spear was maybe 8 feet long, but Alexander's infantry carried the Sarissa, which was an 18-foot pike.
18 feet?
Yeah, it's massive. When the soldiers linked their heavy shields to form a solid wall, those pikes extended far beyond the front line. They created this impenetrable, moving porcupine of heavy weaponry.
Wow.
The Persians relied heavily on light cavalry and showering their enemies with arrows. But against this deeply layered phalanx, the Persian short spears couldn't even reach the Greek front lines.
It basically renders the entire Persian playbook totally useless.
Furthermore, you have a severe motivation gap. Alexander's forces were hardened, lifelong professionals fighting for eternal glory and a share of an empire.
Right, like the Spartans.
Exactly. But the Persian army relied heavily on conscripts and mercenaries drawn from all over their vast territories. They were fighting for a paycheck. So when they hit this mechanized wall of shields and 18-foot pikes and it gets bloody,
just bail.
Those mercenaries simply cut their losses and ran.
And Alexander compounds this physical dominance with some brilliant psychological warfare. I love this detail. After a battle, he would instruct his blacksmiths to forge these supersized, comically large horse bits, you know, the middle pieces that go in a horse's mouth.
Right.
And he'd scatter them across the abandoned battlefield. So that next Persian army marches through, finds these massive pieces of metal, and the rumor instantly spreads that Alexander's army rides giant, monstrous beasts.
It's so smart. He studied Cyrus the Great and understood that morale is just as critical as weaponry. If you can plant a seed of supernatural terror in your enemy's mind, you fracture their resolve before a single sword is swung.
But defeating an army in an open field is one thing. Breaking the psychological myth of an impregnable fortress is another entirely. Which brings us to the absolute geographic nightmare of Tyre.
Oh, Tyre.
This is an island fortress half a mile off the coast of Phoenicia. Massive navy, impenetrable walls. Nebuchadnezzar famously spent 13 years trying to siege Tyre and eventually just gave up.
Because Tyre's strategic advantage was total. Traditional siege tactics required surrounding a city to starve it out, but Tyre could constantly resupply by sea, and obviously you can't roll heavy siege towers across half a mile of deep ocean water.
Unless you are Alexander, and you absolutely refuse to accept geography as an excuse. He literally forces his exhausted army to spend 7 agonizing months constructing a massive land bridge.
A causeway.
Right, filling in the ocean with rock and timber, all while under constant naval bombardment from the Tyrians, just to bring his siege engines up to their walls.
He was proving that there were no safe havens anywhere. And it is worth noting, he initially offered Tyre terms of surrender. In response, the Tyrians murdered his emissaries and threw their bodies from the walls into the sea.
Which is a spectacularly bad miscalculation.
Extremely bad. When Alexander's causeway finally reached the walls and the city was breached, his retribution was systemic. He massacred the men and sold the women and children into slavery.
Sending a very clear message.
A definitive message to every other city in the region: diplomacy is an option, but resistance guarantees your total erasure from the map.
And that terrifying reputation totally precedes him as he moves down the coast. The source material highlights an incredible legend about Jerusalem from the ancient historian Josephus. The story goes that the Jewish high priest has a prophetic dream telling him to go out and meet Alexander in his full ceremonial garments. Yep. And when Alexander sees the priest, instead of demanding submission, he falls to his knees and bows. He claims he had his own vision where he saw the Tetragrammaton, the divine name of Yahweh, on the priest's headdress, recognizing him as the representative of the highest god.
Now, historians widely consider this to be historical fiction. He likely bypassed Jerusalem entirely. But it perfectly illustrates how desperately diverse cultures wanted to weave themselves into his invincibility narrative.
They wanted him on their side.
Everyone wanted to claim that their specific deity had endorsed the conqueror. But his next major destination, Egypt, is where we see a profound, documented psychological shift in Alexander himself.
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, the Egyptians despised their Persian overlords, who had actively disrespected their religion. So when Alexander arrives, he isn't met with resistance. He is welcomed as a liberator and literally hailed as a pharaoh.
And he leans into it completely. He visits the Apis bull, which is the sacred mummified bull. And this is a very deliberate political contrast to a previous Persian ruler, Cambyses, who supposedly mocked and killed the Apis bull.
Right.
Alexander shows deep piety, worships the bull, and in return, the Egyptian priests declare him the literal son of the god Amun-Ra. This feels like the exact pivot point, right? He stops acting like a Greek general, forcefully installing foreign culture, and starts adopting the local divinity.
What's fascinating here is how the scale of his success morphs his original mission. When you have conquered the known world, the mandate changes. He stops viewing Eastern populations as mere barbarians who need a Greek education.
He starts dressing like a pharaoh.
He does. He begins dressing in the traditional garb of an Egyptian pharaoh. The mechanism of his rule shifts from sheer military occupation to divine legitimacy. He really begins to view himself as a visionary missionary, trying to engineer this grand fusion, a unified global culture, synthesizing the very best of East and West.
But the reality on the ground is still incredibly bloody and complex. While he's dreaming of this unified utopia, he's constantly putting out local political fires. For example, he faces a revolt in Samaria after the locals assassinate his governor.
Yeah, and to understand the gravity of that Samaritan revolt, we really have to look at the deep theological rift in the region.
Right.
Centuries earlier, the Assyrians had deported the original Israelites and repopulated the land with outsiders. Over time, these new inhabitants adopted the worship of Yahweh, but they built their own distinct temple on Mount Gerizim.
Which didn't sit well with the Jews in Judah.
Not at all. It created intense generational animosity with the Jews, who maintained that the temple in Jerusalem was the sole legitimate center of worship.
So when Samaria rebels against Alexander, he doesn't just execute the leaders. With the eager assistance of neighboring factions who already hated the Samaritans, he marches in, completely destroys the city, and repopulates it with Greek colonists.
It's a harsh reminder that his grand vision of cultural fusion was still, at its core, built on a foundation of violent demographic engineering.
Redrawing the map by force.
Exactly. But the true test of his fusion strategy arrives after the Battle of Gaugamela. He shatters the last remnants of the Persian army, burns the royal palace at Persepolis, and after Darius III is assassinated by his own officers, Alexander stands as the undisputed king of Persia.
And this is where his vision directly collides with the deeply ingrained culture of his own army. Alexander starts forcing this East meets West integration.
Yeah, he pushes it hard.
He marries Roxana, the daughter of a northern satrap, basically a powerful provincial governor. Then, to solidify his claim, he marries Darius III's daughter. And for the Greeks, who really valued austere monogamous households, adopting Persian polygamy is just deeply scandalous.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, ruling a massive, diverse Eastern empire requires adopting Eastern symbols of power. You simply cannot govern millions of Persians by acting like a Macedonian warlord.
You ever looked apart?
Exactly. So Alexander kept native Persian administrators in power rather than replacing them all with his generals. He became remarkably restrictive regarding plunder, aiming to be seen as a legitimate, benevolent ruler rather than just a foreign looter.
And then he orchestrates what can only be described as a massive forced political assimilation. At Susa, he organizes this mass wedding where he orders 80 of his top officers and 10,000 of his Macedonian soldiers to marry Persian women simultaneously.
Can you imagine?
No. He pays off their debts and offers lavish gifts, thinking this will permanently bind the two cultures. But this isn't team building. For the Greek soldiers, it feels like a hostage situation disguised as a wedding. They are boiling with resentment.
Well, think about what that actually means for you as a veteran soldier. You have marched thousands of miles, bled for years, and now your king is demanding and you dilute your heritage.
Right.
The Macedonians respected generals who lived in the dirt with them. Now Alexander is wearing Persian robes, requiring people to prostrate themselves before him in the Eastern custom and surrounding himself with luxury.
And his inner circle is actively feeding his ego, too. They're constantly comparing his achievements to Hercules and hyping up the oracle's decree that he's the son of a moon ra.
It alienated his core supporters entirely. The veterans felt their king was morphing into the exact sort of corrupt, untouchable Eastern despot they had originally marched out to overthrow.
Wow.
And this ideological friction becomes so intense that during a drunken banquet, a bitter dispute over Alexander's divinity escalates, and he actually murders one of his oldest, most trusted friends.
Which is just the ultimate tragic irony. Alexander has the strategic genius to conquer the known world, the logistical brilliance to build a bridge across the ocean, but he fundamentally fails to manage the psychological exhaustion and cultural pride of the men who actually built his empire.
Yeah.
Was this fusion strategy just brilliant, like centuries ahead of his time, or had he completely lost touch with reality?
As a long-term geopolitical strategy, integration is vastly superior to perpetual military occupation. His underlying logic was sound. The failure was in the timeline.
Too much, too fast.
Exactly. You simply cannot overwrite the deeply held cultural identity of a fiercely traditional army overnight. He demanded they abandon their worldview instantly, and human psychology just doesn't work that way.
And that simmering tension finally breaks in 327 BC. Alexander pushes his army even further east into India. They're fighting brutal battles, encountering heavily armored war elephants, which he is utterly fascinated by the way.
Of course he is.
But the monsoon rains are relentless, and his troops just hit their breaking point. They reach the banks of the Hyphasis River, and they flat out refuse to take another step.
Yeah, they're done.
The most powerful conqueror in human history is told no by his own exhausted men. He yells, he threatens, he literally retreats to his tent to sulk for days.
Mm-hmm.
But the army does not budge. Finally, he's forced to order the march back.
They were battered, deeply homesick, and thoroughly disillusioned with a leader they barely recognized anymore. He returns to Babylon, which he intended to rebuild as the glittering capital of this new fused empire. But then, in 323 BC, at the age of just 33, Alexander suddenly dies.
And the speculation surrounding his death is still intense. Was it a malaria-like fever? Was the wine poisoned by his resentful officers?
This is a huge mystery.
The source material notes he was prone to severe depression, especially after the death of his closest companion, Hephaestion. And he'd been self-medicating with massive drinking binges that destroyed his immune system.
Right.
Whatever the physical mechanism, the man who tilted the world is gone. His body is preserved in a vat of honey, which is just a startling historical detail, and eventually entombed in Alexandria, Egypt.
And the moment he stops breathing, that entire utopian dream of a unified global culture instantly evaporates.
So what does this all mean? He leaves behind a pregnant wife, Roxana, and the largest contiguous empire the world had ever seen. What happens the minute that honey sets?
Absolute unmitigated political chaos. His top generals, who become known as the Diadochi, or the successors, initially feign loyalty. They elect a regent, claiming they'll hold the empire together until Alexander's unborn son comes of age.
Let me guess, that didn't last.
Not at all. That political theater breaks down almost immediately. The generals aggressively turn on one another, carving the empire into personal fiefdoms. Roxana and Alexander's young son are eventually assassinated by a general named Cassander to eliminate any legitimate bloodline claim.
Wait, so none of his top brass actually bought into the vision of an integrated East and West?
They discarded it entirely. They immediately reversed his policies of cultural leniency and reverted to aggressively exploiting the native populations. Ptolemy seized control of Egypt, establishing a dynasty that treated the incredibly fertile region essentially as an extraction economy, just a personal factory to fund his wars.
Right.
Seleucus took control of Mesopotamia and Syria. These generals crowned themselves kings, fracturing the empire and plunging the region into centuries of endless brutal conflict.
It is staggering to consider. You joined us today to explore how a 20-year-old managed to redraw the borders of civilization and plant the seeds of Hellenism, that grand, messy spread of Greek language, art, and philosophy that would deeply shape the ancient world. Yet his immediate political empire shattered the literal second his heart stopped beating.
Which leaves us with a truly compelling historical question to consider based on these sources. Alexander's ultimate vision was a peaceful, integrated fusion of East and West. But given the reality that his own soldiers were already mutinying over his Persian customs, and his closest generals ruthlessly dismantled his empire the moment they had the chance.
Yeah.
If Alexander had managed to survive that fever in Babylon and live to be an old man, would he have actually succeeded in creating that unified global utopia? Or would his own fiercely traditional Greek army have eventually assassinated him for turning his back on them?
That is the fragile tension at the center of the seesaw. You can throw all your weight to one side, you can tilt the entire world, but eventually, gravity and human nature always push back. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.